The gospel lesson today comes from the gospel according to Mark, the 9th chapter. I will begin reading at the verse numbered 38. Mark 9 and 38. John said to Jesus, "Teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name, and we tried to stop him because he was not following us." But Jesus said, "Do not stop him, for no one who does a deed of power in my name will be able soon afterward to speak evil of me. Whoever is not against us is for us. For truly I tell you, whoever gives you a cup of water to drink because you bear the name of Christ will by no means lose the reward. If any of you put a stumbling block before one of these little ones who believe in me, it would be better for you if a great millstone were hung around your neck and you were thrown into the sea. If your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. It is better for you to enter life maimed than to have two hands and go to hell to the unquenchable fire. And if your foot causes you to stumble, cut it off. It's better for you to enter life lame than to have two feet and be thrown into hell. And if your eye causes you to stumble, tear it out. It's better for you to enter the kingdom of God with one eye than to have two eyes and be thrown into hell, where the worm never dies and the fire is never quenched. For everyone will be salted with fire. Salt is good, but if salt has lost its saltiness, how can you season it? Have salt in yourselves and be at peace with one another." This is the word of the Lord. I laughed out loud in my office this week as I read a commentary on this passage from the Gospel of Mark. I can promise you that it's not common to find humor in a biblical commentary. That's not to say that Bible scholars lack a sense of humor, or at least any who might be in the room or joining in worship virtually. One would just not expect to find something funny when it comes to the genre of biblical commentaries. But here's the sentence that made me chuckle. Quote, "Most interpreters insist that Jesus would not have intended that his followers maim themselves." Most. Maybe when Jesus brought the rhetorical heat, it came with a cadence that encouraged call and response. If your hand causes you to stumble, cut it off. And if your foot causes you to stumble, and he waits, and a few disciples shout, "Cut it off." And if your eye causes you to stumble, tear it out, comes the response from the crowd. Though you would probably need to mention a few more body parts to really get the congregation into the hellfire and brimstone sermon, or what we called back in the day the turn or burn sermon. But of course, for any teaching of any sermon, there's always the chance that the rhetorical flair, or the hyperbole, or the illustration, or the example, or the joke for that matter, is remembered more than the intent, the meaning, or the content. That might be true even for Jesus here in Mark. Most interpreters insist that Jesus would not have intended that his followers maim themselves. The sentence sort of indicates at least some distraction in the history of interpretation. In the narrative of Mark's gospel, this language from Jesus comes just after the disciples were arguing with one another about who was the greatest. You remember that Jesus said, "Whoever wants to be first must be last of all and servant of all." Jesus also took a child in his arms and said to them, "Whoever welcomes such child in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me welcomes not me, but the one who sent me." Then, according to Mark, it was John who asked about someone casting out demons. John is playing the role usually reserved for Peter, the disciple's spokesperson, not getting what Jesus is trying to say and then asking the wrong kind of questions or saying the wrong thing. Teacher, we saw someone casting out demons in your name. We tried to stop him because he was not following us. Not following us. Some have suggested the reference to us excludes Jesus himself. John provoked the response from Jesus because the disciples were worried about people not following them. But even if the royal us includes Jesus, the question certainly continues the theme of the disciples' misguided concern for themselves and their desire to claim parochial ownership when it comes to the teaching of Jesus. Yes, it didn't take long for the followers of Jesus to stake in an exclusive claim to the gospel. It started right away and pretty much never stopped since. The church and the "it's our way" or the highway approach to biblical interpretation, theology, discipleship, and pretty much the whole of Christian life. Jesus implies that the one casting out demons was doing it in his name and says, "Whoever's not against us is for us." Whoever's not against us is for us. Jesus turning that old rallying cry, "Whoever's not for us is against us," on its ear. My colleagues on the church staff pointed out this week when we talked about this passage in Mark out under the tent in the parking lot that in Matthew Jesus says, "Whoever is not with me is against me. And whoever does not gather with me scatters." So Jesus says it both ways. That in Matthew was in a discussion with the Pharisees who were accusing Jesus of casting out demons in the name of Beelzebul. Here the turnaround is in the conversation with the disciples as Jesus yet again tries to challenge the relentless urge of the disciples to always make it about themselves. The relentless urge to make the gospel of Jesus about us rather than them. Whoever is not against us is for us. Jesus again turns to an example of a child, a little one, one of these little ones who believes in me. Hopefully those little ones in Mark have gone off to worship explorers before Jesus speaks of lopping off body parts. If any of you put a stumbling block before one of these little ones who believe in me, a stumbling block. The take on stumbling block tends to go one of two directions. There is the morality approach that stumbling blocks come with human sinfulness. With one of my sins, I am then leading someone else to sin. Or a stumbling block understood more in terms of faith, that something in my behavior or language causes someone else to falter in their faith, to backslide, as some would say, doing or saying anything that could cause someone to lose faith. Stumbling block. In Romans, the 14th chapter, Paul puts stumbling block in the context of judging others. "Let us therefore no longer pass judgment on one another, but resolve instead never to put a stumbling block or hindrance in the way of another." In 1 Corinthians, stumbling block comes up again in the conversation about which food to eat or not eat. "Take care that this freedom of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the vulnerable." If the question is whether stumbling block is leading someone into sin or causing faith to falter, the answer seems to be yes. Anything that puts a wedge into someone's connection with God, seeds disinterest in a relationship with Jesus, causes someone to care a little less when it comes to believing, following Jesus. Anything that tears a bit at the life of discipleship. Stumbling blocks. In Matthew, Jesus calls Peter a stumbling block when he was talking about his own suffering and death, and Peter would have nothing of it. "Get behind me, Satan." Jesus and this familiar stumbling block sermon that talks of body parts comes in Matthew simply with the question that Jesus asked to the disciples, "Who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven?" And Jesus puts a child among them and launches into this sermon. But for Mark's Jesus, the stumbling block riff comes in response to the disciples' own self-absorbed conversation. Think about it. Jesus brings some rhetorical heat when he gets apocalyptic in the Gospels. Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be great earthquakes and in various places famines and plagues, and there will be dreadful portents and great signs from heaven. Jesus certainly gets fiery with the religious leaders. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! But here in Mark, all the rhetorical heat, the fiery threat of the worm that never dies, the salty language about ripping out body parts, it's all in response to the disciples' inability to learn that the gospel of Jesus Christ is not just about them. Jesus must have been convinced that the relentless urge to make the gospel of Jesus Christ all about us rather than them was going to drive people away from him. The relentless urge to make the gospel of Jesus Christ all about us rather than them was going to drive people away from him. Yes, Jesus was convinced and apparently more than a little bit passionate as well. One of the worst feelings in the world for a pastor has to be when someone leaves the church because of you, because of something you did or didn't do, or something you said or didn't say. I've certainly had my share here at Nassau Church. The first was in the first weeks after I arrived in September of 2000, when someone came to my office to tell me they were leaving because of all the fuss that came with the arrival of a new pastor. After 4 years of an interim, no one should be that important in the church, was the summary. There have been others and a bit more after the election in 2016. I was too political in my preaching, they told me. But leaving a congregation, of course, shouldn't be equated with a widening rift in a relationship with God. That's a heavier and harder thought for any of us to ponder. That any of us would somehow do harm when it comes to someone else's walk with God. But an even heavier thought, an even harder thought, is to then try to wrap head and heart around the collective nature to it, the collective reality of it. After all, Jesus wasn't responding just to John. He was responding to the disciples. He was responding to all of his followers. He was responding to the Church of Jesus Christ ever since. It's a heavier thought, a harder thought, because we know it's true. The church is a stumbling block. One doesn't need to take a church history class down the street or look around today very long or far to find examples of the church claiming parochial ownership of the teaching of Jesus Christ, or the church taking an exclusive claim on the gospel, or the church and an our way or the highway message, or the church and the relentless urge to make the gospel all about us rather than them. Before anyone thinks I'm just pointing fingers elsewhere, we could all take time together to read the history of First Presbyterian Church at Princeton. It's our history. Back in the summer, a journalist who was writing about the Roman Catholic Church's sacramental theology and decisions about who should receive communion or who should not. A journalist wrote that the church had a responsibility to protect the sacrament. I can't speak to sacramental theology in the Roman Catholic Church, but I do know that the sacraments, the grace of God, and the gospel are not ours to protect, as if they somehow belong to us. No one who hears that sermon from Jesus wants to be a stumbling block. And the place to start, the first thing to do, the part to work on right away, is to worry less about the gospel and us and think more about the gospel and them. All the fiery rhetoric in the world can never distract from this. Whoever wants to be first must be last of all and servant of all. Jesus said that. He said that too. Thanks be to God.